Hello, and welcome to the RichardBarnes.com podcast. The emphasis of the podcast is to show, through others' experiences and insight, a beacon of knowledge, perspective, wit, and warning. A tale of life's lessons, in whatever field. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at richard@richardbarnes.com. Okay, it's time to podcast. Thank you very much for joining the very, very first, soon to be officially named RichardBarnes.com podcast. I haven't come up with a better name than that because I can't come up with anything, you know, truly original. But it seemed to fit the purpose, and I'm quite happy with that.
Great name.
Thank you very much. The purpose of these podcasts is to talk to real people about their real life stories. Now, I find myself quite blessed because I'm around a lot of people that I've got great stories to share, and I figured it would be nice if I spoke to a few of these people and asked them their stories, what they think of things, what the lessons of life have taught them so far, and a little bit of inspiration and maybe a little bit of wit and a bit of warning as well.
Talking to me, that isn't going to happen, I don't think.
Well, this is kind of bizarre, right? Because I'd like to introduce you to my first ever guest on the RichardBarnes.com podcast, a gentleman by the name of Ian McCraner, who I have met twice before. Now, on the first occasion, it was, I don't know, I'm 45 years old now. I know I don't look it on the radio. It's often been said I have got the perfect face for podcasts, and let it be known that it is the case. It is the truth. But I met Ian probably 30 years ago, maybe a little bit more than that. And Ian was working in a little backstreet town called Coventry, which where I grew up mostly, and Ian was working as a doorman. Ian stopped me going into a place, I think it was a dog and trumpet.
Okay.
Okay, you stopped me going into a place saying I couldn't go in, which I was a little bit bemused by, and asking politely the reason why. You told me I was dressed too smart.
Okay, for the dog and trumpet. Okay, what night was it on?
Oh, God knows. It must have been a night that I wasn't working.
A towny night or something, yeah.
I've no idea, but I have never been. I think at the time I was annoyed, but thinking back, actually, I think that was kind of a compliment. I was dressed too smart to go into this particular establishment. And on the second occasion, I think you were teaching at a class I was attending. And I remember you doing leg warm-ups, holding onto some bars at the side of the wall in this gymnasium, kicking between the rungs of the ladder. And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, I don't want to be sparring with this gentleman because you have a lineage. Now, former international karate player, ex-Coventry doorman, who'd up sticks and set up a new life in America. I want to chat to you in chronological order, if I may.
Okay.
Because I find you quite an interesting fellow.
Well, thank you.
That's not in a, you know, that's in a good way. That's in a good way.
That's good.
That's in a good way. Ian, let me take you back to the very beginning, because you come from a town that I grew up in, which is Coventry.
Right.
You went to Binley Woods.
Binley Park School.
Sorry, Binley Park School.
Yeah.
See, I have done a little bit of research. That's as much as it goes. So if you can...
First of all, I was at Chase Primary. I grew up in Willenhall.
Yeah.
And then on to Binley Park.
So what point, because you are an international karateka, you've fought at international level. At what point did your martial arts bit come into your life?
Probably the same as most people, actually. I'm 53 years of age now. So 1970s, mid-70s, most people involved in the martial arts of my age now.
How old were you then?
I started when I was about 12, actually. I was in Aikido.
Right.
At Coventry Boys Club.
Okay.
And the Bruce Lee craze was around, and everyone was looking for a kung fu club at the time to obviously emulate Bruce Lee. And I eventually found, I did Taekwondo for a little while, and then I started in Wadaroo,
right.
Karate. A very short time into that, maybe a few months, I actually ended up having a cartilage operation and I had to have my cartilage removed. So I didn't do anything for a good 12 months. I then started karate again. So it's probably around 1975 that I really started taking karate in seriously.
So what started you? Was it just the Bruce Lee film?
It was a Bruce Lee thing, I think, really, yeah. And, you know, young lads wanted to be something. They wanted to be been known as maybe a little bit tough, can handle themselves, you know, it's a boy thing. And I took it all for no other reason than just wanted to kick people, I think, you know, at that age.
Well, because you lived, I mean, we talked about where you were born and grew up. It is one of the tougher neighbourhoods in the city.
Right. Yeah. You do end up, when you lived in Willenhall, you do end up having a few scuffles on the way back and forth from school. So, but that really wasn't why I wanted to do karate. It was more about just the technical side of it really, really inspired me. I was impressed by, you know, their agility and athleticism. And it wasn't really about looking to look after myself. It was more about being involved in this activity that fascinated me.
When did you realise you were, you know, you were actually getting good at it and started to go for the international fighting?
I was, I think, probably like a green belt in the karate club. And I naturally, it wasn't difficult for me to spar with people. I found it very natural. Train maybe 4 or 5 times a week. Most people were training once or twice a week. I hated the kata. All I had to do it. I hated the kata. I loved the sparring. And I was about a green belt when I made it onto the club senior team. And looking around at all the people I was competing against, I realized this was something I really loved doing. It's something I had a skill for, a natural ability for. And when it comes to the international career, you know, I never really wanted to be a world champion or European champion. That never really occurred to me to get to that height. All I knew is that I really loved the sport and I wanted to compete at international level. Getting onto the vehicle and competing at that level was all I really wanted. And once I made it there, I really didn't enjoy it, to be honest with you. It wasn't something that I wanted to continue doing. You know, you got the likes of the top internationals, world champions, who that's all they dreamt about. All they wanted to do was to be a world champion.
So what did you dream about?
What's that?
What did you dream about at that point?
Just competing. I just enjoyed competing. The enjoyment for me went out of it. Once I had to win, you know, somebody was giving their place up for me if I got selected, and I'm there waiting to compete and I'm expected to win. And for me, the enjoyment kind of went out of it, if you like.
Mm. And so when did you first make the international grade? At what sort of age?
I was maybe 21, 22, and got it onto the England B squad. And then 23, 24, got selected. We fought against Japan at Crystal Palace. And then had a handful of trips after that. And, you know, to be honest, the fire went out for me. I still enjoyed competing. I still enjoyed training. But there was something about it that I just didn't want to do.
What did it lose?
Just enjoyment. You know, when I went out to compete as an individual or for a club team, there was a camaraderie that I really enjoyed. I loved the atmosphere. But when you're traveling to a competition and if you don't win, there's hell to pay. You know, you're not getting a bollocking off anybody, but you're there to do a job now. You're there to win. And for me, the whole aspect of competing was just enjoyment. And for some reason, the enjoyment just went for me.
How were you at school as a pupil type thing? You were educational or?
Not really, not at all, mate. You know, I'm a pretty slow learner. I'm a very, very, very physical person. Academically, I didn't get any qualifications. I wasn't interested. To be honest with you, it took me a long time to grow up, Rich. You know, I think a lot of what I went through with the door work and with the competitive aspect of my sport, I think if I was to do it now, it'd be a different story. Obviously, I'm too old now. But I think it took me a long time to actually grow up, to be mature enough to understand what it is that I needed to do and why I was doing it.
Okay, how did you become a doorman then?
A doorman, let me see. Again, I think that was, again, due to immaturity, to be honest with you.
At what sort of age was it?
I started, let me take you back to my first door work, my first job. I was, somebody came to the karate club, a taekwondo guy came, and he was working as a bouncer in a club on the outskirts of Coventry. And I sparred with him and actually owned him for the whole sparring session. He wasn't particularly good at all. And he told me that he works as a bouncer in this place, and he said, you know, there's some shifts going if you're interested. And I'm 19 years of age, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
And so I went along, and it was the most terrifying, stupid thing I'd ever got involved in my life. The problem with me, again, probably because of my immaturity, was that being a black belt, I bought into the self-defense aspect of karate. If you're a black belt, you've got to take care of yourself. And I was fighting with all the time, if I can't deal with this in real situations on a regular basis, then I guess my black belt is worthless.
So it was ego that made you go back for second day?
Yeah, and the third and the fourth. And I just went through some terrifying times. I mean, being a bouncer is definitely nothing to do with who I am, my personality. But I just stuck with it and ended up doing it for 15 years, can you believe?
15, right.
15 years.
What, all in this country?
Oh, yeah, all in this country. I was most of the clubs and pubs around Coventry, some on the outskirts of Coventry. But it wasn't 15 years span uninterrupted. I mean, I'd take some time off. But over a 15-year period, yeah, I was involved in that. And it was when I look back, I'm glad I did it. It really helped me to identify who I am, you know, what I expect of life. And I recognize who real people are, you know, and what the real world is like. So I would never change that. The problem with being a bouncer, especially in places where you're involved in violence on a regular basis, I mean, the real deal, is that it can't help but have an effect on you. It really does mess your head up.
At what point then, during that 15 years, from being a black belt, thinking, you know, you are equipped to go and do this door work, having a rude awakening after day one, did you actually, you know, forgive me for being direct, actually grow up?
I'm not sure I ever have, actually.
I often say I'm too old to grow up, but yeah.
Too old to grow up.
Yeah.
When I say immaturity, I don't mean acting childish. I mean immature in a way that you don't recognize the way forward. You don't take a step back and then think about the right way to do things. I've been working the door maybe 18 months or so, 2 years, and I'm knocking people out now. And it is horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And not every single person I'm hitting, and you know what it's like in Coventry, you know how things happen. Every time I'm doing that, I'm taking it home with me. I'm thinking about, could I have done it another way? Could it have been me? Why am I still doing this job? You know, if you're working at a few places, you can actually earn pretty well at that. And I was teaching karate in the evening, going to the pub, then to do the door, then onto a nightclub. So I was earning pretty good money. And to just stop all that was very difficult for me. Plus, I wasn't sure that it was something I wanted to stop at the time.
Yeah.
I knew I needed to get out of it, but I wasn't sure why I wanted to get out of it or what I would do different. And also, as you know, you spoke to a lot of bouncers in your time, there is kind of a... There's an accolade that goes with it. You are somebody.
A mantle.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe a few years in, I realized that I didn't need that. I think at that point, maybe I had grown up and realized I didn't need to do this anymore. But getting away from it, you know, as you know, is very, very difficult.
Was there a one particular thing, or was it a one particular incident? Or was it an evolution over a period of time that made you come to that conclusion?
It was a over time evolution. You know, after many, many attempts to quit. And that's why I said there was like a break in it. I'd stopped and came back, stopped and came back. You stop and then somebody says to you, oh, there's a shift at so-and-so going. And you realize you're probably a bit short financially. Okay, you go back to it again. And then you're in it for another year. And then you quit again. And then somebody says... Somebody needs the help. Okay, I'll do a few nights. Then you're back into it again until you say, okay, enough's enough. I can't do this anymore. Because of the stuff that I've been involved in, not being, I confess, I am not what you'd call a fighter. I'm somebody who had to become a different person to do that job. And because of that, and many people listening to this now, I'm sure they'll agree, they'll understand. I've had some serious anxiety problems. You know, I've had. Have you ever had a panic attack, Richard?
Yes.
You know what it's like then?
Yes.
It is probably the most scariest thing that can ever happen to somebody. You literally think you're going to die.
It's a bit like, it's a bit like being in the garbage compactor on the Death Star in Star Wars.
Where the that's a good example.
Where all the rubbish is coming up at you. There's a nasty snake-type thing in the water below you, and the walls are coming in, and you're trying to scramble up the sides. That's kind of the way I can sort of verbalise it.
Right. How do you... If you've been there, you've felt it, what is it you do to make it go away?
I learned a coping mechanism. I learned, and then it was simply to sit down quietly and breathe and concentrate on breathing. And once I could oxygenate my body, my brain would start functioning. I would stop being so insular and thinking about the one thing, and my perspective would widen, and at which point I could start to rationalize exactly what was going on. But only right. only at that point, only had I learnt that coping mechanism, was I able to deal with it.
Right. It's terrifying. And I tried to research a little bit and find out how, and I don't understand the medical reasoning for it totally, but basically when you've had so much stress in your life and you've had to deal with so much violence in your life, eventually it comes to a point where your body just reacts. That fight or flight that you get, that you know if that danger's in front of you, you can recognize what it is. So because it's in front of you, and when the heart starts pounding, the stomach goes, the sweaty palms and all that feeling, and the shortness of breath that you get, you recognize it because the danger's in front of you. But when it happens, when you sit having a cup of tea, and suddenly things start happening to you, you just don't know why it's happening. And, you know, this is why I'm not a big lover of the UFC. I'm not a big lover of what I think is gratuitous violence that's on the television. Those people involved in the cage fighting, they're having a great time now, and fair play to them. You know, it's up to them. They're having a great time now, but the amount of violence and the aggression they're involved in, there's no doubt they're going to pay for that in later years. They're going to start having what you and I have had, panic attacks. And it really can affect you. Can you hear that woodpecker now?
I can hear the woodpecker. Ian was saying just before we went on air that there might be a noise in the background, and it's a woodpecker. I was explaining, actually, if you've come across podcasts I've done before, you'd probably be familiar with the noise of my dog, Marley, who often goes to sleep beneath the desk where I'm recording and starts snoring. He's not here today, but Ian's wooden pecker is satisfying the background noise. But no,
sorry about that.
No, yeah. Let me just bring it back though, because okay. I'm interested. You know, there's two things you said there. You enjoyed the camaraderie of the karate club. You've obviously enjoyed and engaged in the camaraderie that came with the door, and you also talked about, you know, being a different person when you were in the door. Have you ever spoke to somebody that, you know, you've known for a long time? How would they have described you then as a type of person being immersed in that sort of world? Would they describe you as a fundamentally different person to as you are now?
Probably not to speak to or to be around. But let me try and equate this. My business right now, Rich, is totally different to what I've been doing in the UK.
Yeah.
Is weight loss and fitness.
Yeah.
And they're actually massively linked, and here's why. For somebody to lose weight, they have to change who they are. Somebody can't lose weight being the person they are. The reason being is if you agree that the more you do something, the better you get at it, that would mean the more you fail at losing weight, the better you get at failing. So what happens is, when you start something, let's say you start weight loss, and when you start weight loss, your brain looks for a file that's in there that knows about weight loss. And if all you've ever done is fail, then it knows how to find the fail file. So this overweight person says, oh, I'm going to go on a weight loss program again. And the only thing that person knows is how to fail.
Yeah.
So it's no wonder that they fail to get again and again and again and again. What I get people to do over here is to totally change who they are. I've got to get them behaving completely, totally different, because it's impossible. Let's say Richard, I know you're not now. I've seen pictures of Richard in great shape, and especially after yesterday as well.
God bless you.
These mini marathons. But let's say Richard...
Excuse me. I'm not comfortable with the word mini marathon. I'm more comfortable with the word half marathon. A mini marathon could be like, you know, 20 yards down there. You know, when you say mini, all I'm thinking of is Dr. Evil, you know, and his mini me. And it's not a small marathon. It's 13 miles, and it was quite a long way. But
okay, let's call it 13 miles.
Thanks very much, Ian. That makes me feel a whole lot more manly.
Well done for that. Let's say Richard weighs 22 stone. Let's say you do.
Yeah.
And you try to lose weight many, many times. You are not going to lose weight knowing what Richard knows and behaving like Richard behaves. I've got to bit by bit ask you to behave like somebody else. Somebody who loses weight gets up in the morning and does something completely different to what Richard does, which is a massive change. They dress differently. They go to different places. They expect different things of their life, which is very, very difficult to do. But once you become that person, then that person runs parallel with Richard until we can make that person take over. So now Richard's become somebody else. Now you can do it. So a great analogy there, Rich, would be if I was to give a make-believe man a dumbbell and say to that man, by lifting this dumbbell, you're going to make that the process is lift it for so many reps. And what you're going to do is then you're going to rest. And then you're going to feed that muscle, and that muscle will then grow. So he says, fine, okay. So he lifts the dumbbell for so many reps. He rests, and he eats correctly. Anyway, after a short while, he says to me, I'm seeing no difference in my biceps. And I say, well, are you doing all the correct things? Well, yeah, of course I am. I then discover he's actually got a damaged or broken wrist. So he wasn't lifting the weight that he's supposed to lift. He was lifting what he could lift with that wrist.
Yeah.
Here's saying to him, lift this dumbbell for this many reps, rest and eat, and you'll see a difference. But he neglected to tell me he got a wrist problem. So what I should have done is fix his wrist, then he can go ahead and do what's prescribed.
Okay.
People are doing is, metaphorically, they are trying to lose weight with a broken wrist. They're trying to lose weight the person they are. The first thing you've got to do is change who they are and then get them to do what's required.
Was this the same methodology that you employed to get yourself off the door?
No, it's the same methodology I did to get myself on the door.
Right.
I couldn't do what's necessary as a bouncer being me. I had to think like, walk like, if you like, talk like, read about and visualize. I'm into bed, Rich. I'm sure a lot of bouncers listening to this will be the same. I went to bed visualizing the knockout I had that night and the next one that I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I would see the person in my mind's eye, their legs buckle. I would watch them fall to the floor. And before they hit the floor, I visualized kicking them in the head and watching them completely unconscious and then dealing with the people around them. And I was doing it again and again and again because I had to be that person. I couldn't be somebody who wouldn't do that if it actually came on top one night. I had to be prepared to do that. And because I lived it, it affected me. And it affected me greatly because I was acting like somebody else. It wasn't me.
Okay.
So I had to then, when I got off the door, it took me a while to get back to the person that, you know, I like being. I'm not a violent person, but I was very good at violence towards the end of the career. And I'm very, very lucky and very blessed that I didn't end up in a lot of trouble for it.
You up sticks after your 15 years and tenure on the door and your martial arts, and you changed locations, home. And it wasn't just down the road to another city. You actually went from the UK to the Americas and set up home in Indianapolis.
Indianapolis, Indiana, yeah.
And that's, may I ask the reason for the big transformation and the thought process behind it?
I fell in love with America many, many years ago. The England team came over here to Chicago in 1984, and I made some acquaintances here. And from that, I got invited to take some club teams. So I bring some club teams back to the States, which I did. And again, make more acquaintances. And then I just ended up settling here. And It's a big move. You don't realize what a big move it is at the time. The culture, you'll hear people tell you that Americans talk English, but we are separated by the same language. And you've got to live here to understand that. It really is true. Yes, America is a nice place to live. The people are awesome. The American people are absolutely awesome. But I can't get away from the fact, and people will think I'm absolutely crazy saying this, Coventry is a fantastic place.
Mm-hmm.
It's not until you move away from Coventry that you realize what an awesome country England is and what a fantastic place Coventry is. And the people of Coventry are unbelievable.
Yeah.
To think about being in England full time for me again wouldn't be a problem whatsoever. There was a point at which I thought I couldn't go back because what I've got here now is a lot better. And it wasn't better, it was just different. But I wouldn't have any problems living in Coventry full time again at all. I think Coventry's a great place. The people are great. The problem I see with an awful lot of people who don't understand, I'm not trying to belittle anybody and say that they're stupid, but they don't understand is that, especially when we're talking about door work and being a bouncer, I met some of the worst people in the city. And I was surrounded by a lot of the arseholes in the city. But when you look at the percentage of people that actually go out on a night time in Coventry, it's a very, very small percentage of actually living in Coventry. And I was only ever seeing a lot of the scum that was out there. I don't mean the people going out for a drink were scum, but the people I was dealing with were assholes. But the vast majority of people who live in the UK and live in Coventry are awesome people. So moving to America was a great move for me, but it was more of an eye-opener and more of an adventure, really. So it isn't somewhere that I can see myself staying permanently. I'm back and forth now with business I'm doing.
Yeah.
It isn't somewhere that I would say, I'm staying here and I don't care about the UK. I'll always be a Brit.
I think there's a great analogy that I often use in conversation, that you don't know what you really have until it's not there anymore, which is often, you know, we always hear people speaking ill of those that have passed on to the next life or whatever. So and then they say, I wish I'd had chance to say these words to them. And another analogy I use is the fly on the TV screen. You'd imagine the fly sitting on the TV screen to having the best view of everything. Well, actually, right. All he can see is a few pixels underneath his foot. It's not until you actually step back from the TV screen do you actually get the full picture, which is quite interesting to hear you describe Coventry in which way it was. Because, again, just to give it a little bit more context to your story, Coventry was statistically the most violent city in Europe per capita, per population, during the time that you were on the door. I'm interested then. So you've gone from being a doorman, you've gone from being an international karate player, and you've upsticked, made a massive life change, and you've gone to Indiana. What did you do when you're there? You set up a new business? You set up with what you knew from the UK?
Let me see if I can explain. This is probably the whole American thing could probably be a podcast on its own. But let me try and give you the short version. Once I was here, my thought was, because I was involved with karate people, that I would just continue with the karate. But again, that didn't work for me because karate in the States all those years ago is similar in the UK now. Karate has always here been a business. And that means bringing in hundreds of children and teaching on what they call here, a black belt program. So people sign up for a few years at a time and they go on a yellow belt program, maybe a green belt program, up to their black belt program. So they're contracted in for many years. And I couldn't buy into the business of it. I really couldn't. So
what's wrong with that, Ian?
Sorry?
What's wrong with that?
Nothing wrong with it whatsoever. But
what do you think's wrong with it? I mean, I know it's horses for courses. You obviously didn't buy into it. What was it you didn't like about it?
I didn't buy into the fact that every single person was just getting their belts. It wasn't like they were grading and getting a belt because their standard was good. They were grading, getting the belts because they were paying money for it. And so, you know, anybody in the UK those years ago will know that maybe 60% of people took their grading and actually failed their belts because it wasn't a business. Most people were teaching out of church halls or little huts or whatever it was. And they were doing a daytime job as well. A lot of people working as bouncers to supplement their income. And they're teaching karate not as a business. They were teaching karate because they love karate and they didn't care if people left. And I really couldn't buy into the business side of karate because of the standard. I don't think there's anything wrong with these so-called, they call them McDojos now. I don't think there's anything wrong with getting hundreds of kids into a hall and having fun with them. And that doesn't sound too good, is it? Yeah. getting hundreds of kids into a hall. Giving them games to play.
Yeah.
But then awarding them with a belt that says to them, this belt brings something with it. This belt means something. It means you're technically proficient. It means that you have got a great standard. When it didn't mean that at all. Once the martial arts became a business, the whole landscape of the martial arts changed for me. And I just couldn't find myself buying into that.
Because I read an article where you said the door-to-door karate salesmen are not responsible for making karate look bad. They are merely vultures perched waiting for karate to die so they can feed off the carcass. I mean, you've been a vocal critic of the way in which karate is conducting itself in many countries and on many levels.
Right.
Because you feel it is not true to what the ethos of karate is or how you view it?
I think people are lying. I think what they've done is that there's nothing wrong with getting a lot of people to kick and punch and to have them have fun. But if a belt means something, it's like, you went to college, right, Richard? You got a degree or?
Yep.
Okay, if you went there and they just gave you and the people around you a degree and...
Means nothing.
It means absolutely nothing. You'd probably be upset with it. You know, you've worked really hard to get your degree and now people are getting it for no reason, just for turning up. You'd say, well, why did I bother? Why did I bother doing all that work? Anybody can get this. Once it became something that wasn't elite anymore, that anybody can get, then it became pretty worthless. And I actually felt embarrassed about talking about having a black belt because you felt part of what's going on now. You know, the black belts are out there that are really, the standard is terrible. So I just thought people were being conned.
So you've carved out a niche in Indiana, where you're teaching based on karate, but something different, Ian McCraner's take on it.
Right. Well,
what is that?
Well, what I'm teaching now, well, I was in Las Vegas. I met a guy out there who taught a group fitness class in LA, in California. And I went out and spent a few weeks with him, and I was watching what he was doing. And I was doing something similar for many years in the UK, actually, fitness-wise, but he had a whole new take on it. So I came back to Indiana and started teaching classes, and it really, really, really took off. I had classes of 50, 60, 70 people at a time, predominantly females just wanting to get in shape. I became, in essence, a group fitness instructor. And with a background as a bouncer, with a background as an international karateka, can you hear that woodpecker again?
I can hear the woodpecker.
It keeps coming back. Sorry about that.
No, carry on.
With that kind of background, it kind of gave a lot of credence to what I was doing in the fitness industry. And I know a lot of karate people in the UK. Tell you what, mate, give me a second. I'm going to move out here because this thing is damn annoying me. One second, sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen. Here. Please hold on a moment while we deal with the wooden pecker problem.
Right. Let me get that here. That is unbelievable. Okay.
So you met this guy in LA. You met this guy in Las Vegas.
Yes.
He was teaching in LA. He gave you an insight and you came back and you started to teach big groups of people.
I started teaching group fitness, and that became something that I really I really enjoyed, and it became that became who I was. I realized who I was because there is no faking being in shape.
Yeah.
You know, you can fake, you can put a black belt on, or you can put a gi on and pretend to be something by the belt you wear around your waist, but you can't say that you're thin when you're fat. You know, it doesn't work. So in the fitness and the weight loss industry, what I've got is this massive crowd of people in front of me whose goal is not to get a belt and be recognized by that belt around their waist. What they're trying to do is to achieve a weight loss and a fitness level. So the bullshit was completely out the window now. There's no faking it. And I love that because I'm talking to people about their diet, about their workout, and about how they can get in shape. And then week by week, month after month, you can see real total results. And the realization that the vast majority of people, Richard, the vast majority of people will never, ever be able to lose weight and keep it off. Ever. It's impossible. And that really surprised me to learn that. And it also made me realize that you really have to change, totally change who you are to become anything. You can't do or become successful at anything with the person you currently are, because if you're already failing, if you keep doing what you're doing, you'll keep getting what you've got.
So you took what you did,
yeah,
and what you learned, and you modified it to provide results for other people, and at the same time found the fun back in the training that you'd lost.
Oh yeah, I absolutely love it now. You know, I'm kicking like I used to kick when I was a youngster. I'm still moving around. You know, I'm probably in the best shape of my life right now because I'm involved in fitness. There's no violence in my life. There's no aggression in my life. There's no expectations of anything really. It's just I go and I work out. If my diet's good, I feel good. If my diet's bad, I feel bad. You've lost quite a lot of weight, haven't you? And you've got on the fitness wagon fairly recently, right?
Well, no, to be honest, I'm the other way around. I've been on the fitness wagon for a lot of years, but I had this, and I still have this issue with portion size. I am a glutton. If you put, you know, a huge plate of food through it, I will clear the plate, and it's wrong. And I had to change my attitude to it. I mean, I did the London Marathon and went up and did Everest Base Camp in 2005, and I was 15 and a half stone.
Wow.
And it's only recently, only, you know, 18 months ago, that I've come down to being 13 and a half stone, which is a good weight for me. Technically, if I get on the scales, I'm still pushing the overweight mark if you go by the body mass index.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But I don't think I am, but, you know, having done three half marathons in 21 days and a triathlon as well, I think I'm ticking over all right. But,
oh, good God, yeah, that is tremendous. That's unbelievable.
But having said that, I'm just interested in the way in which you've used what you've done before, modified it and changed it, and you're using the karate as well within what you're teaching now. I mean, obviously as well, it must have other benefits because, you know, you're teaching karate to people, they're getting fit, and they must be good at defending themselves as well for fight situations.
Well, no, not at all. As you know, self-defense actually has nothing to do with fighting. It's completely, totally different subject. If you were to ask this question to all the top self-defense instructors out there, ask every one of them, how many times have you defended yourself in a situation that wasn't bouncer related?
Right.
You would be shocked at the response. If they are fighting regularly, then that is because they live in an environment or in a place that is very violent. But you've been on many courses, you've met a lot of bouncers, you've been involved in a lot of these self-defense courses. How many of those people who don't work in a
fighting environment?
Right, door work environment, security environment. How many of those people have actually had to work their self-defense in real life?
Yeah. Yeah.
They'll tell you probably never. And even the top self-defense instructors will tell you the only time they've ever had to do anything violent against anybody, defend themselves, as if it were, was as a bouncer or a bouncer related.
Yeah.
So if that's true, then the vast majority of the population are never going to get themselves in a fight. They're never going to be in a fight, most of them. They never are. So that would mean that understanding how to defend yourself is unnecessary. What is necessary is to understand how to not be in a violent situation in the first place. That's the main thing.
Self-defense starting with the self, then.
Exactly. I mean, how many of these self-defense practitioners have walked out the room where they've done their self-defense course and lit up a cigarette, or gone and ate, you know, a big curry, and followed by a few pints of lager? They're not really concerned with themselves, what they really enjoy. And again, fair play to them. It's nobody's business telling them they can't do it. What they really enjoy is being part of that ilk. They like the atmosphere, like I did with the karate and with the competitions. They enjoy being part of that training regime. They enjoy it.
But there are other benefits, though, aren't there, Ian? I mean, you can go on a self-defense course and whatever, especially if you're suffering with things, you know, you're being bullied, for example. Going on a self-defense course would surely, you know, help, you know, deal with bullying.
Well, you can hear what you're supposed to do, but can you pull the trigger? At what stage do you pull the trigger and hit somebody? And in the ideal world, you'll hit somebody, you'll stop them, and it's all over. But when is it? It always continues. It's never all over. The only real way to not be involved in a violent situation is to avoid those situations. It sounds like a strange thing to say. A lot of people are going to say, well, you can't avoid every situation. Well, of course you can't. But the average person, not the self-defense inclined mentality person, the average person is never going to be involved in a fight. They just aren't. Yes, you can cherry pick people who've been jumped on the street and mugged or stabbed, but most of this happens, it's either drug related, it's alcohol fueled, it's on a night out somewhere, or it's, you know, somebody has pinpointed you to mug you. But if you're aware of your surroundings and you make provisions for your surroundings, most of it can be avoided. And I think if self-defense was taught 99.9% avoidance, and be a hard target, don't be a victim, then that's probably the way it should go. But the people involved in the combat sport, combat arts, and they label it with self-defense, I just think it's wrongly labeled. It's more about self-preservation than it is self-defense.
So, okay, if going on a self-defense course is not the ideal solution, and you would suggest for bullying, does Ian McCraner advocate a particular system, a particular methodology for alleviating being bullied?
For being bullied, I think you have to work on becoming, like we said earlier, becoming somebody who can't be bullied, somebody who won't put up with being bullied. You have to change. You have to work on your personality. Try and think of the people you knew, who you know already, who are walked over, who are bullied. People tell people how to treat them. Their mannerisms, the things they let people say to them, they become a victim of bullying. And there are people that you know who somebody just will not bully, that they would choose an easier target.
Right.
There is no easy answer, but my worry is that you've got a lot of people who go to self-defense seminars thinking that they're going to learn ways of defending themselves. And there is, you know, I hate to say it, but hitting first, as we know, is probably the only way to do it.
Okay.
If it's going to kick off, being first and getting out of there is the only way to do it.
You were suggesting there that that people that have been bullied are open to being bullied. Yeah, are open to being bullied. Is that because they have self-esteem issues? And is there a way to change that?
That's a difficult one. Doing
what you do, making people fit and taking the elements of your training that you do, does that change people's lives and their perspective?
Well, it does, because we talk about that, strangely enough, even though it isn't a self-defense class that we do, it is a fitness class. We do talk about self-defense because it crops up, because what we're doing is asking people to change who they are. And just by changing their body shape is a self-esteem issue. And I've seen so many people who dropped an awful amount of weight. And here's what happens to them, Rich. When they drop weight, they dress differently.
Right.
One of the things we tell people when they get involved in this weight loss program is the first thing you need to realize is that the reason you're overweight, and whether you agree with it or not, and believe it or not, some people do think this isn't the case, is because you're eating too many calories. You're going to a restaurant too many times. You're drinking too much alcohol. So what I want you to do is take those nights you'd normally go to a restaurant and go to a gym instead. Take those nights you go to a pub or bar and go to the gym instead. Now, the people you're going to meet in the gym, you're going to have different conversations with. They're going to invite you to places you wouldn't normally go. As the weight comes off, you shop in different places. When you shop in different places, you have a different perspective of life. You then start feeling different about yourself, which may then in turn say, okay, I've now lost, for example, if somebody said I've lost 5 stone. Oh, wow, my holiday destinations choices have changed. Instead of going here, I'm going to go somewhere where I can probably rock climb, or I can go hiking, which I wouldn't have thought about before. So your holidays change. So losing weight isn't about just losing pounds. You end up losing the person you were. And the places you want to go, the people you're going to end up meeting, your lifestyle completely, totally changes. And during that, the conversations can stem from all kinds of things. We talk about everything. And self-defense does crop up. Because these people, when you see them walking in after they've lost, you know, I'm trying to think in pounds now, mate. I normally do it in pounds. You know, you have somebody who's lost 70, 80 pounds.
Yeah.
And that they walk in, they're wearing completely different type of clothes. They look fit. They look confident. Their behavior is different. And just their mannerisms and their behavior open up doors to places they never, ever thought they could go. And we do talk about self-defense. And these people become very more confident with themselves. They're fitter. They're stronger. They're healthier. The problem with that is that they can be overconfident.
Right.
And that's when you need to talk to them about, if they're talking about self-defense, learning to fight is not going to save anybody, because a fight that happens is never these days about you and one person. So if the person you're going to be fighting against, or two or three people, overpower you, you're still in trouble. You do not want to be in the fight in the first place. So, you know, in terms of self-defense, I think so, the days of self-defense and self-defense classes are numbered. That's a very strange thing to say, but I think that they're numbered. It's not as, or going to be anywhere near as popular as it is now. I think it's a dying breed.
I'm very interested in what you're talking about when it comes to self-esteem and the way in which, you know, you're becoming a different person. And you were an advocate, you know, for training. You're saying go to the gym, work out, get fitter, because it will improve your life, and your esteem that you're having yourself will improve. That's a bottom line message that you've learnt, and something that you are an advocate for now.
Absolutely. People will tell you, overweight people will tell you, that they're quite happy being overweight. If you said to them, give me $5,000, I'll give you a pill that will drop every single bit of weight you've got and you'll be thin and muscular, I don't know anybody that wouldn't at least think about it.
Mm. Especially at today's exchange rate, it's only about 3 in the UK.
But what happens is that, and the reason I say that the majority of people will never lose weight is that their life's too busy, Rich. A great analogy would be if you would take a glass and fill it almost to the very top with water.
Yeah.
And I said to you, that glass represents you. It represents every single aspect in your life. It represents your family, the music you listen to, the car you've got, the house you've got. It represents every single thing about you, that glass does. I want you now to add weight loss in that glass. You say, well, there's no room. There's no room to add weight loss. You've got to remove 2/3 of that glass to make weight loss possible.
Mm.
It isn't just about eating differently and about exercising. It's about changing so many things in your life to make weight loss possible.
So you go and do all these things, Ian. You go and do all these things. And again, you've been teaching this for a lot of years now. And, you know, people only have to have a look at photographs of yourself to see that, you know, you're not only talking the talk, you're actually walking the walk.
Thank you.
What is the upside for Joe Bloggs that goes and takes on this attitude, this ethos, this way of living? Is it really worth the effort?
For most people, this sounds terrible, and people will tell me that this isn't the case. But the world is getting fatter. You've got a time in history now where the access to information has never been so easy.
Yeah.
You can get on the internet 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can buy videos. You can go on YouTube. You can find all the information you want about every single thing, any time of day and night. And the world's getting fatter. So if you look at those facts, I don't believe that the vast majority, and this is terrible, the vast majority of overweight adults will ever, ever be able to lose weight. It's just impossible. The weight loss industry understand this. They know that that's the case. So what they do is they try and sell things that we're talking about, the glass with only a little tiny space in the top.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen a thing in the UK. There's a thing here called the shake weight.
Not heard of that.
No. If you got online, look for it. It looks quite obscene. It's a shaking thing with your hand. If you look at it, you'll see what I mean.
Yeah.
But they advertise they show a bodybuilder who's obviously on steroids, who's in great shape, and he's shaking this bit of plastic. And they advertise this thing, and although they don't say it, the implication is by seeing this guy doing this that he got in shape shaking this thing.
Right.
I think it sells at $19, $99, $20. But it says it's a 6-minute-a-day workout. So, and they sold 20 million of these things. And probably more.
Right.
Because people realize their lives are so, so busy. And they think, well, worst case is I lose $20. Best case is I get in shape. What really happens is they lose $20 and the company makes hundreds of millions of dollars. And they believe then that it's their fault they couldn't lose weight because this thing is advertised as money back guarantee. It works. But what they're doing is telling people, you can do this at 5 minutes a day, because the weight loss industry realize people don't have time. You know, to do what you're doing is 2, 3, 4 hours a day, every day, including diet and exercise. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many people can do that? They can't. You know how hard it is to work out. So how does somebody who is 100 pound overweight even start to do what you did? How'd they do that? When they've got a full-time job, they've got kids, they've got debts, they've got, you know, a busy life. It's absolutely impossible for the majority of adults to lose weight. It will never, ever, ever happen. So, you know, this brings me nicely actually onto, we created something to try and get kids involved, because if we can catch the kids and get them active before they even get fat, then that's where the answer is. The answer doesn't lie with the adults. Most adults, I think, are doomed.
And that nicely brings you on to, have I not been feeding you a line all the way through this?
You have been.
No. Because I do want to bring that in, because I want to bring into actually what you are doing at the moment, because I know you've got work a lot with the kids and you're encouraging them. You're taking what you've done and I know you've had great benefits and results with people you have worked for, and their lives have changed, their self-esteem has increased, and their own, their old self is gone, and the perspective that which they you know, judge the world has changed, and therefore not just them, the people that know them around them are affected by that. You know, that the service is just knocked on, which is, you know, which is a great lesson. But yeah, tell me about the stuff you're doing with the kids, and tell me about, you know, the tag pad and the Mac X tag game that you do with the kids as well.
That's called Max Tag. This is all linked together, actually, Rich, because let me start with, if I was teaching karate, and anybody who teaches a karate club will tell you that, or a boxing club, actually, when you start the kids on sparring, you can lose about 67% of them, because there's now contact involved, and there's now having to think about how you can spar with somebody in front of you who the adrenaline kicks in. The training part of it, not so much, but when you're actually facing somebody to spar, the adrenaline kicks in. So I tried to explain to some of the people I was teaching that what you're really doing is, whether it's karate or boxing, it's actually a glorified game of tag. What you're trying to do is you tag them, they don't tag you. Of course, there's a lot more involved in that, but it's at its basic level, it's a glorified game of tag. So how do we get kids to move around and play tag that they're really going to enjoy? Well, I looked at the model that the so-called McDojo uses. Mm. They have hundreds and hundreds of kids in there, and all they're doing is playing games, but they're giving them belts for it. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to be associated with that. So what do I do? So we created a game where you put they call it a vest over here. In the UK, probably called a tabard type garment.
Yep.
That has Velcro straps on it. And we created a patch that is double-sided Velcro. The gloves and the hands have also got the opposing Velcro. So one has got hook, one has got loop on. Now, all the kids do at the basic level is move around trying to put Velcro onto Velcro. When they connect, it pulls that patch off. Now, what they can do then is the patches are collectibles. There's things on some of them that kids want to collect. Other ones allow them to pick up points. But basically, they're moving around as though they're sparring, but they're not actually having to think about good technique or get a belt as a reward for being technical. All they're doing is playing. And there are hundreds of kids who are having a ball just playing this game. All they're doing is tagging each other. And they don't even realize that they're burning calories. And of course, at the end of a session, we can then talk to them and do talk to them about the reason you're so tired is not just because of your fitness level. It's very, very much to do with the fact that your immediate energy comes from your food source. And then we talk to them about what their food source is. So we're doing the job that maybe a school isn't doing because the schools are tied to a lot of red tape where there's certain things they have to do in the school. We haven't got to do that. I can talk to them about, let's talk about the journey of that Snicker bar you ate. What does it do? It goes in the mouth, it goes down your throat, goes into your stomach, it's broken up, and then it starts sending nutrients to the body and feeds the muscles to give you energy. And then we start talking about what's in that food and why that isn't helping. And when they change their diet even slightly, I can say to them, you felt fitter today, you did better today, your muscles didn't give out so much today because of your diet. So they're learning diet, and they're learning to exercise without any real structure as such. All they're doing is having fun. Now, this actually helps or will help a lot of martial art clubs because this can bring hundreds of kids into their dojo and they haven't got to compromise their karate standards by keeping kids there, by giving them belts. What they're doing is these kids are winning patches. And they're winning points by collecting patches, and those points end up turning to prizes for kids.
Yeah.
So we've got something now that an awful lot of people are interested in.
It ticks all the right boxes.
It absolutely does, it's perfect. And what we needed then, Rich, was to create a training tool that you could practice on. So we created a pad that you can take the patch off and put it back on again.
Yeah.
And it really is a training tool that is – allows you accuracy. It makes you use a muscle correctly. And bottom line is, it's just a lot of kids having a lot of fun with no expectations. That's all it is.
And you, it's something that just benefits all the way through, ticks all the right boxes, and create improves their fitness and makes them aware of what's going on. And again, using the experience that you've gained thus far on your journey on this spinning blue marble thing.
Exactly.
Okay. Tell me about the tag pad then.
That is the tool I'm talking about, the tag pad. That's getting an awful lot of interest.
Yeah.
From all kinds of areas, really, because it is.
So the Mac X tag is the Max tag.
It's called Max tag, but it's M-A-C-X tag.
And that's the game for the kids.
That's the game.
And the tag pad is the training aid that you're talking about.
The tag pad is the training aid. Now, if you were a karate martial art instructor, this can be used in various ways. Self-explanatory when you see it for accuracy. But instructors can also use this to test their students outside of a normal grading, because we have now, or we're putting together, 50 different skill testing patches so that you can get a student in the interim from the 3 months for their grading, where the kids want to pick up a roundhouse patch. They want to win their patch for their roundhouse to the head. So on the pad, there's a series of skill tests that they do on the pad, where they can an instructor can test the student, and when they hit the pad so many times or take the patch so many times, they then are awarded that patch. So it's a great way of keeping kids interested, and it's a great way of the instructor actually making a bit more income too, because they were charged for the test.
Just for to tick the marketing boxes, where can people find more out about these things that you're doing, Ian?
You can find out everything about what we're doing actually at maxtag.com. So that's MACXTAG.com.
Okay. Are you ready for the killer question?
Uh-oh.
I've been wondering actually with these podcasts, there is something specific that I want out of each question I wanted to ask each person.
Okay.
Here's the question I've kind of formulated for today for you. Without being rude, and you're not a lady, so I can get away with this. How old are you now?
I am 53.
You're 53. 53-year-old Ian gets to have a chat with 18-year-old Ian. What would you tell 18-year-old Ian now, from what you've learnt thus far? What piece of advice would you offer him?
What advice would I offer an 18-year-old? I would tell an 18-year-old Ian.
I'm just after one bit. The one thing that you've come to hold dear, or one thing that you might find useful, whether it's something completely simple, something completely witty, or whether it be something profound.
Profound would be, I think, I would say, out of everything I've ever learnt, I would say humility. I would without a doubt say you need to, as quickly as possible, become humble, to respect other people's ideas and views, to hold your friends very, very close, to just love people really, Rich, to be honest with you. That would be it. Humility, I think, is probably a very underrated word.
Ian McCrane, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you for being my first ever victim on the richardbarnes.com podcast, and I wish you well.
Thanks very much, mate. Appreciate it.